supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. According to a survey conducted by National Life Insurance Company, 40% of employees say their jobs are either very stressful or extremely stressful. In addition, most of these employees report that the stress they feel comes from conflicts between their work and their family life. You know, it's always been a problem, but it seems worse than ever these days. Employees feel if they don't dedicate themselves 100% to their work, their jobs may be in jeopardy. And technology these days, do I even need to say anything about it? We also want, of course, what's best for our children and our other relationships. We want to give them our time and our energy. And how many of us feel guilty that we're not doing a good enough job with either one? Well, I've got two guests today who may offer different ideas about how or if we balance our careers with our home lives. Here in the studio is Julie Cohen. She's a career and leadership coach in the Philadelphia area, and she consults with the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. She's written Your Work, Your Life, Your Way, 7 Keys to Work-Life Balance. Julie, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dr. Dan.
I'm also joined by Marty Nemko. He's the host of Work with Marty Nemko. It's our NPR affiliate on KALW in San Francisco. He's also a career coach, psychologist, and author. His most recent book is How to Do Life, What They Didn't Teach You in School. And his website is martynemko.com. He joins us by phone from the West Coast. Marty, welcome to the show.
My pleasure to be with you.
And, of course, our phone number is 888-477-9499. Tell us if you struggle with work-life balance, or perhaps you've got it mastered. Share that with us. 888-477-9499. So, Julie, here's my dream for the takeaway of this show. It's for you to define work-life nirvana and tell us three or four steps we can take to get there. So do that now, and then we'll all go have lunch.
Well, I don't believe there is a work-life balance nirvana, and it's not something for me to define. I actually think there's two myths around work-life balance that set most of us up for disappointment in this area. The first myth is that work-life balance looks a certain way and that we must fit it. And the second myth is that work-life balance is even something we ever attain. We may get close to it. There may be days, weeks, and months where it might feel right, but life is messy.
This concept of balance, Marty, you know, I think of the word balance. I think when I was a kid and I balanced books on my head or, you know, a seesaw with a friend, and we were just at that, but it doesn't stay. I mean, you just don't stay balanced. It's not the way things work.
Yes, balance is the word that has been extolled all the way from Aristotelian days. It was the golden mean. And indeed, President Obama and his wordmeisters have used that word balance to describe everything from the NSA snooping, balancing security with freedoms, to the debt crisis, to illegal immigration. It's something that intrinsically feels great. And I'm glad that we're spending an hour on this show, because there's a lot of nuance involved, as Julie is implying. One size does not fit all.
Well, according to Wikipedia, the phrase work-life balance was first used in the United States, Marty, in 1986. And that might suggest something was going on in the decade of the 80s, perhaps. And I think that's about when the digital age was born. So would you make that connection?
No, I think that's correlation, not causation. I think more likely the women's movement has always tried to have changes in the workplace, to have a smaller demand on workers, so that women and men could spend more time with family. I think that was the causal variable.
Julie?
The key causal variable.
Well, I can speak in the mid-80s as I was graduating college. I had a very unique image of what I wanted for work-life balance.
Oh, what was it?
I assumed I was going to work hard as I needed to be successful. That's what my parents from, the baby boomer generation and even earlier expected. But then when I graduated college, I wanted fulfillment. I wasn't willing to work the 70, 80-hour work weeks that I saw some of my fellow graduates doing.
What do you attribute a lot of that to the women's movement?
I attribute that to more choices. Yes. So, I mean, if we equate that to the women's movement, yes, I had more choices. I didn't have to work one certain way, and it didn't have to look a certain way.
Morning. I want to read a quote from something you said in Business Insider. You said the real winners of the world, the people who are the most productive, think that the notion of work-life balance is grossly overrated. Most of the highly successful people I know work single-mindedly towards a goal they think is important, whether it's developing a new piece of software or a cardiologist who is seeing patients on nights and weekends instead of playing Monopoly on the floor with his kids. Really? You really feel that way?
I think it goes well beyond a feeling. I have always, because my father is a Holocaust survivor, and what helped him most heal was not recreation or processing it or therapy, but feeling very productive. He was a very productive person at work, and one could describe his life as, out of balance, and yet he felt extremely, to use Julie's excellent word, fulfilled. For some people, yes, fulfillment comes from family primarily and from recreation, others from balance, but at least over the 4,000 clients that I've worked with over the last 26 years, and because I'm so interested in work, I speak about work at parties with my friends. Of course there's exceptions. We're all humans and we're all different, but the people who, on average, who feel best about their life, who feel most contributory, I'm not talking about financially necessarily, although certainly it correlates with that as well. On average, those people who feel best about their lives and most contributory, most fulfilled, are indeed those who do work long hours, if you have a job that could be rewarding.
Let me argue something with you, if I can, and I want to be very careful here because of your father. Now, he worked as a Holocaust survivor, and my hunch is in the Holocaust, everybody wondered if they did live, what would their lives be? Would they ever be able to make a contribution to the world? And discovering that he can or could, I'm sure he didn't want to stop. I'm sure he didn't want to stop, and it became very meaningful to him. I think there's something in there, Marty, that's universal about that. All of us, I think, want to make a contribution to making the world a better place, even if it's not conscious. I don't know if you know this, I'm a quadriplegic, and right after my accident 30 years ago, what changed my life around was that when I discovered I could be helpful to a nurse, mm-hmm. who was depressed and suicidal. Mm-hmm. It changed my mm-hmm. life around. Mm-hmm. And I was the same way, but then life intervened. And there were more joys in my life outside of work. God knows, I don't want to compare what I went through to your father. But, I wonder what he taught you about work and its meaning.
I'm really glad you raised that point. I've been very careful to not overgeneralize from my own family's experience. I think that's a mistake that many people, quote, experts do. It
yes.
happened to me, and therefore it generalizes. But as I said, most of where I've derived my views that one size does not fit all. Indeed, for some, who have soulless jobs, if you're marketing a soulless widget, you're an anonymous cog in a wheel, one could certainly understand that one would find greater fulfillment in family and avocation and creative expression. But My message here is one of nuance. It's one of one size fits all. And over the 4,000 clients that I've worked with over 26 years, I have, if I put in a room all of those people and my friends and colleagues who are most content with their lives overall and feel best about putting their head on their pillows, most of them, not all of them, work 50, 60, 65 hours a week, and in some periods more, some periods less. But I just am concerned about the broad brush movement that seems to be accelerative of work-life balance is something that everybody should strive for. And dare somebody be, you mentioned this cardiologist who chooses to work with more patients to save their lives evenings and weekends, rather than denigrating them as, quote, out of balance, insisting on a one-size-fits-all approach, we, let alone calling them workaholic, which implies that they're addicted to something bad, I would argue that we should allow in our souls to call them hard workers or even heroes rather than insist they fit the one-size-fits-all mantra of workaholic.
It's a really interesting take. That was Marty Nemko. He's a career coach and educational psychologist. He's on the phone with us from San Francisco. I'm also joined here in the studio by Julie Cohen, who's also a career and leadership coach. Listen, I'd love to hear your thoughts about what Marty and Julie are saying or your issues about work-life balance and your struggles. We're at 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Nine. Julie, I'd like you to weigh in on what Marty said.
Well, I agree completely with Marty's statement that there isn't a one-size-fits-all. Where I see different with my clients is, regardless of what my clients come to me for, whether it's to be more effective professionally, to expand their leadership skills, to be a better communicator, to handle conflicts in the workplace, I'd say just about 99%, if not 100%, of those people have also struggle with, you know, what we call work-life balance. And that work-life balance definition for each of those people is very unique. Some of these folks are working 60, 70 hours and are energized by it and love it. And they're feeling guilty and regret that they're not spending time with their kids or not playing piano the way they want to or not getting to the gym. And there's folks who are working in what we might think is a very traditional role and aren't as engaged in their work and want something else. So I don't think, you know, it's black and white that, you know, just because you work 80 hours a week, that's good. We really need to look at what is it that the person wants and how do we support them in getting closer to that.
Most people I know and work with are who bring this to my office are weighed down by the shoulds. I should be more productive at work. I should spend more time with the kids. I should all these things. And I ask them, what do you want? And you know what? The answer is always the same. I don't know.
So what I see is the issue of unreasonable expectations. It challenges us in at home and at work. Others have expectations of us that have a tendency to be unreasonable. And more importantly, we often have our own unreasonable expectations that consistently make us disappointed. So when my clients come to me with those same questions, we approach them differently as a therapist versus a coach. I ask them to define what it might look like, what that more preferred expectation is, and then help them get there.
Marty, do you find that also, that people who come to you are burdened with these shoulds?
I couldn't agree more. I'm loving this conversation. Dan, I'm loving this conversation. I think it's really good. I think it's exactly, we're focusing on the right thing, the notion that there are these shoulds, whether it is we should work harder or we should spend more time with the family. I think that one of the nicest things about this current era is the lack of rigid stricture. The notion that indeed we celebrate diversity not only of race, but of approaches to life, single parenthood, dual parenthood, co-parenting arrangements, work, part-time work, people who work 80 hours a week. And I think that the shoulds are really born of an older tradition that is perhaps even originated in religion, where things are more black and white. This is a great conversation about nuance. The message should be to everybody, maybe, there are certainly some shoulds. I mean, you know, under most circumstances, thou shalt not rob. But is it really a great time for all of us on this call and listeners, to think about, are we following too many shoulds? If we want to spend more time with family, should we insist on more rigid boundaries in our life? If we feel like, no, my hours 40 to 60 during the week would be better spent if I am, let's say Julie is probably a wonderful coach, and if she chooses to spend hours 40 to 60 helping more human beings to flower rather than quantity time with family, thinking rather, you know what, it is quality time that matters. She should not be guilt-tripped into a should that she should be spending more time with her family. I think those are intimate, personal choices.
I just have one observation about what you said, and what you said is wonderful. Just one observation here, Marty. You sound surprised that you're enjoying this conversation. You and I have to have a talk, young man.
I hear so many of these conversations that are too polarized, too black and white, not intelligent. I just was an emotional reaction to this conversation. I'm enjoying it.
It's NPR, buddy. You know about that.
I know, but I'm really liking it anyway.
We're talking about work-life balance today with Julie Cohen and Marty Nemko. And as Marty said, I agree, we're having a wonderful conversation. Marty is a career coach. His website is Marty Nemko. That's NEMKO, MartyNemko.com. His most recent book is How to Do Life, What They Didn't Teach You in School. Julie Cohen consults with the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, and her book is called Your Work, Your Way, 7 Keys to Work-Life Balance. Our phone number here is 888-477-9499. I promise I will interrupt this conversation to take calls after our break. So it's 888-477-9499. Seriously, we would love to hear from you and how you work out this work-life balance thing. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has been providing services to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Founded locally by pioneering schoolteacher Helena Devereaux, the organization now helps individuals across our nation to live healthier, happier, and more productive lives. Over the next 6 weeks, Wawa stores throughout southeastern Pennsylvania and New Jersey will help support Devereaux's work. More details at local Wawa stores.
We're glad you listen regularly to Talk of the Nation, but please don't let your involvement end there. We want you to take an active role in shaping each day's program. Call us or send us an email and make your voice heard. Your opinions matter. I'm Neil Conan. Join the conversation next time on Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking with career coaches Julie Cohen and Marty Nemko about work-life balance. Our number is 888-477-9499. Marty, I'd like to hear your take on what's happening in the 90s through today. More and more we take our work with us 24 hours a day, even when we're home or on vacation. That really changes the paradigm, and the genie's not going to get back in the bottle.
I think that's right, and that, you know, that's the part that's kind of sometimes beyond your control. I mean, if you were to say at work, I'm not taking my laptop or my smartphone on vacation, it in many workplaces would be seen as inappropriate. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe there is an answer, a partial answer in this. You know, workplaces, you know, we're talking about this diversity, one size fits all. There are different workplaces that have very different cultures. There are many cultures that do celebrate work-life balance. And they're not just in the nonprofit sector. There are corporations, as one that I am consultant to, I guess I can say it, Genentech, and they have an amazingly strong commitment to work-life balance. And so when you are looking for a job, if you are in that, have the option of doing that, you know, maybe you need to shop not only on salary or on how much of a societal contribution the job can offer, but what is the workplace culture? Is it a 60-hour-a-week culture or a 37-hour-a-week culture?
Julie, you made a face. That's the price you have to pay for being in the studio with me. You made a face when I talked about this 24-hour-a-day thing, and Marty said you have no choice. But I have to say, Julie, I agree with them. I mean, there are some cultures where you have to. Your career could be at risk. But at what cost, Julie?
So I think it's really important that we always feel we have a choice. So those choices can be local or they can be more systemic. So, you know, technology can be a real asset. It can give us more flexibility if our organization allows that. And it can keep that 24-hour-a-day clock going if we feel we can't put down our BlackBerry or we have to be responsive immediately. So when my clients are faced with those struggles, I think they need to have some conversations with their colleagues, with their, you know, their managers, to really understand what the, you know, Marty mentioned about the organizational culture. And there are a variety of cultures that either can give you some flexibility or say, you know, this is black and white. And then I think, you know, the real powerful thing is looking at our own boundaries. What kind of conversations can we have in the workplace? And I think people are afraid of this. I've seen this over and over again. I can't say that, you know, two nights a week, I don't want to be connected. And often having a conversation in a non-threatening way and trying to feel out what your manager, what your team is comfortable with, you can actually take some small steps that give you a little more control. So to me, it's, you got to always look locally. You can think globally, but you need to be very local.
Well, I want to make this question even more difficult and more complex. I mean, you're talking about a conversation with colleagues and employers. How many of us, Julie, myself included, and Marty, I want you to weigh in on this too, with all the digital stimulation, it's about our reactivity. And how many of us, myself included, can't distinguish between what can be ignored and postponed and what's urgent, emails and text. You know, we hear that little ding, and it's like a call to action. It's like our bodies become an alert.
Well, I think we have been reprogrammed, and that, you know, our technology has made us more anxious, always feeling on the edge. And unless we, each person in their specific situation, start saying, is this working for me? Is this enhancing my effectiveness? Or is this making me so crazy? Am I always multitasking and I'm not being efficient? I'm not getting anything done. I want to do something differently. So again, I think the conversation and an assessment of, is my technology serving me or is it making me crazy?
Marty, you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, I'd love to. And I'm going to weigh in with a personal anecdote about last night. I'm with my wife, this was fine. We do live a very busy life, but last night was, or yesterday afternoon and last evening was kind of hangout time. And so we were doing some, it couldn't be more relaxing things. We were playing Gin Rummy with our favorite CDs playing on in the background. But periodically, as Barbara got up for whatever reason, she did look at her email in her smartphone, in her iPhone. And you know what? It was pleasure. She likes it. It wasn't you know, Dan, I agree with you completely that when it's this, you know, you're a Pavlovian dog and you hear bell and you must respond, that, of course, that takes, again, the choice out of it that Julie and I and you, I think, are all in favor of. But, frankly, Barbara and sometimes me enjoy, you know, playing Gin Rummy with me is all well and good, but it was fun to see what was coming in her email. She did not look like it was an oppressive thing. It was an enhancement, and that's where, again, I agree with Julie, one size doesn't fit all. Is the technology making your life worse, or is that moment in time, that 1 minute where she looked at her email, or 5 minutes, in case it was more like a minute or three, is that overall more both not just pleasurable, but beneficial to society? Will it take some work off her plate for Monday? It's not that necessarily the technology is bad or good, but I agree with Julie. It's asking yourself, am I happier doing that, even if it is interrupting, quote, family time?
And I think to do that, you got to put all that technology down, sit down, be quiet, You know, stop flapping your lips. Don't do anything and just reflect on your life. And so many of us allege that we don't have time to do that. We've got a ton of callers who want to join the conversation. I feel like I'm hogging you guys. Let's start with Nicole. Hi, Nicole. You're on the air.
Hi, Dan.
Hi.
Hi, Dan. Can you hear me?
Very well.
Great. Thanks for taking my call. Like I told your producer, I'm a single mother. I work a full-time job and a very part-time job. I have my children full-time, except for every other weekend, for about 48 hours. And I feel like I have really good balance. I don't call it work-life balance. I just call it life balance, because there's a lot of life, and it doesn't all have to do with work. And, you know, I think that finding a sense of purpose, which I do in volunteer work, and giving back to myself, which I do on my weekends. I don't feel guilty about not having children on my weekends. I take care of myself because it puts me in a better place to do everything that I need to do for those 10 days that I'm back on full burner.
Nicole, let me get this straight. You've got two kids. You've got a full-time job, a partial-time job, and you volunteer. And you've got work-life balance. There's something wrong with you.
I don't think so.
How do you do that?
I don't think so either.
Well, she's a superwoman.
Really? I'm baffled.
I really think that it comes to, I believe your one guest had mentioned, finding a great deal of purpose. And whether you find that in work or you find that in life, I believe that that creates a lot of joy around you. And, you know, I found it in work for a number of years, and I hope my boss isn't listening, but I don't have tons of purpose in my job now. But I find it in my life in other ways. And I think that, you know, and that creates that kind of balance where I can work every way that I need to work in order to have insurance and pay the bills and cover the mortgage and the car payments, et cetera, and, you know, do what my kids need to do. They're 11 and 13, so they're coming into a very expensive time of life.
Wow. Wow.
And, you know, I think as long as I'm not afraid to, and I think that's it, too. I think it's not being afraid to give back to myself and to acknowledge that, you know, I do have a purpose. I think that makes it gives me broader shoulders to be able to carry the rest of my life without complaint, I suppose.
Well, Julie, do me a favor. If you ever, Nicole, do me a favor. If you ever find any spare time at all, would you mind running my life for me?
I only can guarantee my own, and I have two children. we have a rule in our house. They always want pets, and I say unless I can put you in a cage and neglect you for a weekend, then you can't come and live here. So I hate to tell you, Dan, I have some rules to live by.
All right. I'm going to say goodbye to you, and I'm going to ask our both of our guests to weigh in on that. Julie, let me start with you.
So hearing what Nicole said, there were two, I think, well, there's many wonderful things she shared, but there's two I want to highlight. First, it sounds like she's very clear on her values, and she's making choices aligned with those values to do meaningful, engaging work outside of her professional her professional responsibilities. And that in itself is really energizing. So that's one of the first exercises I do with my clients and people who attend my workshops is remind them, the more clarity you know on your core values, and if you can make choices that reflect them, you are likely going to feel really satisfied. And that can minimize the intensity if you are working, you know, a job and another part-time job. The second thing that I just want to, you know, applaud Nicole for is her focus on self-care. You know, she said, you know, on the weekends, whether it's when her children aren't there, she does things that take care of herself. We don't know what that is for her. It's very personal. It might be exercise. It might be play the piano. It might be, you know, go for a walk or read a book. But that's what refuels us. So I think we need to do whatever it is that gives us energy and take good care of ourselves.
Marty?
Yeah. You know, what I was struck by is we're awake 100 hours a week. And the people who feel like they never have to, you always hear somebody say, if you want something done, ask a busy person. The people like her, like Nicole, realize that time is our greatest treasure. It really is our most valuable commodity. And I didn't hear her say that she spent a lot of time in front of the boob tube. I didn't hear her say a lot of time that she plays golf for 18 hours, you know, three times a week. She's made a point of spending, saying that she spent her full-time job and she's got a part-time job, both of which she finds reasonably rewarding, and volunteer work. That's what I am seeing. People who don't fritter away time. It doesn't have to be, you know, the word work is always defined as that which is too often defined by work-life advocates as that which you have to do so you can get on with life. But in fact, many times work is unpaid or paid. But what really counts is it contributory to the life well led. And it seems like Nicole spends a lot of her 100 hours on various activities which contribute to the life well led.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Jane on the line. Hi, Jane.
Hi, good afternoon. How are you?
Okay. What can we do for you?
I just had 2 points. I think that unless you're your own boss, and I think the majority of middle America is not in a position to choose how many hours they can work. They have to work as many as it takes to meet their life's needs, whether they have kids, don't have kids, have to want to do a full-time job plus a part-time job. And so many people don't actually even have a career that they can choose. Is this going to be rewarding or am I going to be putting in time? The workplace has changed so much with the level of unemployment in this country, and even people who have really good jobs, and I love my job, I have a great job, but when I'm at my job, I'm expected to be working at my job every single minute. I mean, so many employers are, if you are not up on your feet doing your job, you can go now and take your own time and use it.
Because so there's a lot of people waiting for your job. Julie,
exactly. I think in the digital thing actually makes my life easier because the kind of work I do, I can say, okay, well, if you need me, call me back, you know, and I'll come. And that gives me, I have a lot of flexibility, which I don't think most people do. You know, I don't think work-life balance is maybe not the best way to, I think Nicole brought that your last caller said it very well. It's more about finding a way to make your life work.
Yeah, Jane, I think you bring up a terribly important point, and one that I was going to bring up also. Marty, is this whole issue of work-life balance, is it a luxury to even have this choice? Is it a luxury where most people don't have the luxury to struggle with it?
I think there's some truth to that. What I'd like to springboard off that is, very often, the core problem that we're worried about is: is your life so stressful because of the demand? You know, if you work too many hours, will you be too stressed out? And at least from the clients I've worked with, and what makes sense to me, frankly, it's not something I learned in my PhD program. But if you're doing work that you're good at, you can do it a lot of hours. If you're doing work that you're not good at, you can do it for short hours and it's going to burn you out. If you're rushing, if you rush through things, even if it's short hours, it's going to burn you out. I listen to you, Dan. You are a nice slow talker. You're slowing me down. I tend to talk way too fast. But you are good at what you do, and you don't rush. And therefore, I would argue that you're less likely to burn out or need much more work-life balance because you're doing what you're good at, and you're not rushing. You're the go-to guy. You've been doing this for a million years. So you're not, when the red light comes on, you're not unduly stressed. You've taken the time to do, as Malcolm Gladwell said, become an expert. You know, you have. So those are the three-legged stool that I think are the greatest, more than the work-life balance kind of quick pill, let's just spend less time working. If you're doing what you're good at, if you've taken the time to get good at what you're doing at, and you don't rush, then I think that is more likely to lead to more productivity, less burnout, less stress, and feeling better about your life, more contribution too.
You make a really good point. Of course, what makes my life easier is I'm really only good at one thing, so that simplifies things a bit for me.
It's critical. You need to be a specialist, an expert. You can't be an expert at lots of things. That makes your life less stressful.
Julie,
do
you think men and women handle this work-life balance differently? It seems, you know, men might get criticized more if they say to their boss, I want to get home more, you know, or feel more shame by saying, I can't do that. So they're going to work. I mean, how does this break down with gender?
So what I see, I do see some distinctions in gender, but where I actually see the greater distinction is more generational. So I do a lot of work at the Wharton School where I do an 8-hour workshop on the content of my book. Those are, you know, high-achieving professionals, late 20s, early 30s, you know, who were working in big jobs, took 2 years off to go, you know, get some of the best education in the world. They know they're going back into very big, very demanding jobs that they want, and they have expectations that work is not going to be all-consuming. And my audiences there are, every time for the past 5 years, 50-50. Now, when I go into an audience where there's, you know, people in their 40s, 50s, Gen X, baby boomers, it's, you know, I think the gender issues are more pronounced. I see much fewer men saying that this is an issue, and I see more women struggling with it.
I wonder if that was the case forever. You know, that younger men, you know, just work. I mean, that was the case in my generation back in the mid-1800s. You know, you know, men struggled with that. Tell me your take on this, Marty. How does it break down with gender and generation?
I do think that women in general, because they have a desire to be contributory to the larger society to make money, but also, you know, I don't know if it's environmental or it's oxytocin and estrogen, but women generally have a greater desire to be with family and probably greater desire for self-care. So I do think that there is, on average, and there are many exceptions, but on average, I think women are more interested in what has been called work-life balance.
We've got to take a short break now. When we come back, I want to get to some practical stuff. I want to hear about the advice you offer, Marty. I want to hear, Julie, about your program. And we will get to more callers. We're talking about work-life balance. Marty Nemko is a career coach. His website is martynemko.com. His most recent book is How to Do Life, What They Didn't Teach in School. By the way, he's got a radio show also. It's on San Francisco's NPR affiliate, and it's called Work with Marty Nemko. Julie Cohen's a career leadership coach and here in the Philadelphia area. She consults with Wharton. Her book is Your Work, Your Life, Your Way, 7 Keys to Work-Life Balance. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY FM.
1 in 3 families is affected by problems caused by drugs or alcohol. The Family Training Program is a service for those concerned about their child, age 12 to 25, that may be using drugs or drinking. If eligible, you will be invited to sessions with a family specialist to help make positive changes in your life and in the relationship with your child. Held in Philadelphia by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More at 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-I-WORRY-2, or online at iamconcerned.org.
Supreme Court rulings,
the Boston Marathon bombings,
presidential press conferences. The news does not stop between Morning Edition and All Things Considered. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. Starting July 1st, you'll be able to hear the NPR news you rely on in the middle of your day.
And I am delighted to welcome Jeremy Hobson as my new co-host.
Here and now.
Don't miss a thing.
Weekdays at 1, beginning July 1st on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're talking about work-life balance with Julie Nemko, with Julie Cohen and Marty Nemko. I just had you two married.
I was just going to say, yeah, maybe we're agreeing a fair amount, so maybe
really?
I just meant to.
Not that much
piano,
balance.
I'm guessing. Do you play the piano?
What?
Do you play the piano? Because you mentioned it twice.
You know, it's funny, I did mention it twice, and yes, I do.
So do I.
Okay,
so we should play a duet here before, as we go out. We should. I've got a piano sitting right here. We should instead of your regular outro music, I should play something as your outro music to show work-life balance. We can even embed work-life balance into a radio segment.
Marty, I love that idea. Don't do it. Listen, I want to get down to brass tacks here. Part of the advice you offer your callers on your radio show is about diversity, and I trust you're not just talking about investments here.
Right. I'm not a big fan of value void diversity for its own sake. I'm kind of at my core, if there was one word to describe me, it's a meritocrat. But when there are alternate points of view, points of ways of living, ideologies that are worthy of being brought into the feisty mix of conversation, then I'm really a fan of diversity. And I think work-life balance is a good example. You know, I just hate to see, and I see it so often, these very hard workers being denigrated as out of balance or workaholics, pathologized. And which is dispiriting. I know people who really do work hard, not, you know, sometimes for the money, but very often not. And I just think one size does not fit all. We should be honoring our hard workers rather than this. I've seen 10,000 articles on work-life balance. I haven't seen one ode to the hard worker.
Julie.
Well, I think the issue is choice. So working hard is fantastic if you're doing it. And it's, again, aligned with your values, and you're making the choice. Now, sometimes we make choices that are in conflict with our work-life balance preferences. You know, as Marty acknowledged, playing the piano. I went 18 months a few years ago when I was writing my book, and I stopped taking my piano lessons. I was frustrated. I missed my piano, and I had a very, you know, focused goal of writing my book. So I needed to pull back. And to me, this is a lifelong journey, my work-life balance choices. So, you know, it's hard work and choices.
And like we said in the beginning of the show, this issue is fluid. Balance is not static. So instead of beating yourself up, just know that it's fluid. I've got to lean this way now and then the other. Tell us about your program.
So I have a program, 7 Keys to Work-Life Balance, and the full program is a very intense 8-hour workshop where in the group and each person in the group assesses their strengths related to work-life balance, what's working, and areas where they need support. It might be looking at their priorities. Do they know what's important? It's looking at boundaries. Are they able to say no in the right places? Looking at their efficiency. How are they managing their day? Are they making choices that make them more effective? Or are they constantly multitasking? And, you know, as you described earlier, Jan, you know, that feeling of the anxiety of always being connected. And there's a few other keys where we need to look at, are we affected by them? Are they slowing us down? Are they lessening our work-life balance satisfaction? Mm-hmm. And if they are, there are tools and strategies related to each of the 7 keys where you can make concrete choices to behave differently.
Name those keys. I don't want a whole book summary, but just name them.
Key 1, develop priorities. Number 2 is create boundaries. Number 3 is manage your day efficiently. Number 4 is design reasonable expectations. Number 5 is reprioritize your values. Number 6 is navigate an unbalanced organizational culture. And number 7, which I think is, I saved the best for last, is engage in self-care.
So there you go. I mean, that's what my first question when we started the show is, what's work-life nirvana? So there it is.
Well, and even in that case, though, you know, there's going to be days, weeks, months, sometimes years where we may have to make difficult choices. You know what? I'm not going to focus as much on self-care because I want that big job. I want to work, like Marty's saying, I want to work hard, and it means I'm not going to get to the gym or I'm not going to train for that marathon. But what I'm getting from another choice is giving me that fulfillment. That's okay. I want to lower the stress that, you know, and I guess either you or Marty were talking about guilt. I want to lessen the guilt around difficult decisions.
Let's go to the phones. We've got Donna on the line. Hi, Donna.
Oh, hi, Jan. Hi, Dan. Thanks for taking my call, and hi to the guests. And I have to tell you, this couldn't be a more timely topic. The mention of a cardiologist was made earlier, which I am not, but I am a cancer doctor. And after having fallen ill by not knowing how to take care of myself on a yearly basis, another physician and I at our training hospital in the Philadelphia area speak to the incoming residents, the new doctors, and we will do that tomorrow. Also this year, we know that a physician study came out describing that probably over 70% of physicians who are practicing currently in the country who responded are burned out, which to me seems to be the opposite of what you're trying to model and teach. So I was wondering, for that particular community, the healers that we need to probably help heal, what practical suggestions would you have for that community, upcoming doctors, or it could be other people choosing to train to get to a career where they're making an investment that's very timely, very personally, professionally, physically demanding?
Marty?
I love that question. It's unfortunate. I wish that we could fast forward and we all could just be transformed 200 years from now. But unfortunately, medical science, the practice of clinical medicine, is still primarily an art. Despite all the data, despite all the research, we are still, relatively speaking, in clinical medicine's infancy. So there remains a lot of guesswork. There is a lot of art, and yet the stakes are so high. And, of course, the challenges of getting into medical school are Herculean, unnecessarily so. So there is a sense of, you know, I've got to put in all this money, work to pay back my student loans. But I've got this sense of entitlement. So they have this hubris very often when they're with patients or with nurses. There is tremendous stress. So in this case, I would beg, and I have a lot of doctor clients, they've got to give themselves a break. They're just at a too early a stage in the development of the profession to be the masters and be right often enough. And so I think they need to give themselves a break and realize. I'm going to tell you one story about residents at Albert Einstein Medical School. When they greet the new interns, this may be an apocryphal story, but I don't think so. The chief resident says to them, "Each and every one of you is entitled to one clean kill. There's going to be a patient who's going to walk into this hospital and expect them to come out fine, and you're going to screw it up, and you're going to be responsible or contributory to their death. But your worth as a doctor is the sum total of your life's work, not the errors you make." So I think doctors who work so damn hard really need to take a deep breath and realize they can't control everything.
I did a workshop years ago, coincidentally two workshops, for couples. And one workshop was doctors and spouses, and the other workshop was for clergy and spouses. And it was interesting that the issues were the same in both workshops. And I realized after I was done that what they had in common was they both gave up their first name for their career. So you're not doctor as much as you're not Donna as much as you're Dr. So-and-so. And you give up an awful lot when that becomes who you are. Julie, how do you want to weigh in for?
Well, I think we're seeing two things. The our values conflict. We have, you know, in the medical profession, you know, people are so committed to this field and they're willing to do what it takes to be successful and impact their people. I think there's a natural struggle. I see healing professionals, you know, whether it's doctors, I actually have a clergy client and in other professions who struggle with this because it's so connected to who they are. So again, we need to give them space to assess, you know, how do I want to be in this fully engaging profession? There might be times where I need to step back. You know, at the beginning of a medical career, that's probably not likely it, but there may be times. I've had doctor clients who've made some difficult choices and pulled out of intense fields and taken a couple years off to still be involved in medicine, but not necessarily in the same intense way.
I see that a lot, but shouldn't we be looking at the culture? And that's what Donna implied, you know, we talk about individuals, but there was a study, for example, done by Harvard and McGill, found that United States lags far behind all wealthy countries when it comes to family-oriented workplace policies, like maternity, paternity leave, paid sick leave, and you know, all sorts of personal support. So let me turn to you, Marty. How do we change the culture, or do we?
I think I have got to give a nuanced answer. I know you want to hear me say we need to change it. I think if I own, I own a candy store, a small candy store that has 10 employees. I have X dollars. I'm terrified of being competing with some other, my competitors putting me out of business. I have X dollars. Do I spend it on having an on-site child care? Do I offer a paid family leave in a state where it's not for paternity and maternity leave? Does that going to render my risk of going out of business? Or should I expand my line or open a second store or spend it on advertising or research and development on what customers want? It's, you know, it is a zero-sum game, so it's very easy to embrace the notion that, oh, yes, we should have more, you know, flex time or this, more that. But there's a price and a benefit to everything. And with everything in life, I wish the whole world did more of their thinking in terms of cost-benefit, risk-reward. That things are, you know, everything comes at a price with a benefit.
Julie, I've got 30 seconds left. I want you to answer this question, that there's research that shows that employees who feel cared for and about by the culture tend to be more productive.
Yes, that research I've read, and I agree this. And I also think if we put all of our belief that the organization is going to take care of us, we're going to be disappointed. So I want the and. We want to work to have organizations change their culture, and we need to say, I need to drive my choices, my career, and my vision of work-life balance.
Well, with that point, we are going to have to end. Julie and Marty, you've been great. It's been an important and fun show with you guys.
Mm-hmm. My pleasure.
It's been my pleasure.
Thank you.
It was great.
Next week on Voices in the Family, we'll meet meditation teacher and author and just a well-known human in the Buddhist community, Sharon Salzberg. The interview's going to be riveting. Well, comment on today's show. We're at whyy.org/voices. You can download this or other Voices shows there. You can follow us at Twitter. We're at Voices in the Fam, and I am at drdangottlieb.com. We would love to hear from you. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez Luna is the executive producer of audio content. Anna DiStefano is our summer intern par excellence. Emily Haas is our production assistant, and she directed today's show. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn's our producer. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Have a great week, my friends.